someone in the Castro government to attack U.S. forces at the Guantanamo naval base. Neither President Kennedy, the CIA's inspector general, nor JFK's new CIA director had ever learned about the CIA's fake Guantanamo attack planned for the Bay of Pigs. The inclusion of a similar idea in the Joint Chiefs Northwoods proposal in 1962 suggests that the head of the Joint Chiefs in the spring of 1962, General Lyman L. Lemnitzer, who'd had that same position in 1961, had been a witting participant in the CIA's original Guantanamo provocation. From a practical point of view, this makes sense. So the fake CIA attack could have been coordinated with the U.S. military at a high level. The Northwoods proposals shocked President Kennedy, and he rejected them all. The plan apparently showed JFK that some of the Joint Chiefs, especially its chairman, General Lemnitzer, were very much out of touch with JFK's view of the world. Within months, JFK replaced Lemnitzer with General Maxwell Taylor, who had headed JFK's Bay of Pigs investigation. General Taylor would remain chairman of the Joint Chiefs throughout JFK's presidency, and was so admired by RFK that he named one of his sons after him. The Cuban Missile Crisis, which most Americans think began in mid-October 1962, had its own complex history, too long to detail here. Still, in many ways, it was the culmination of 3 years of U.S. covert action against Cuba, including the CIA mafia plots, massive U.S. military exercises in the Caribbean in the summer of 1962, and two small raids into Cuba sponsored by Operation Mongoose. The first U.S. official to sound the alarm about Soviet missiles in Cuba was CIA Director John McCone on August 10, 1962, even though his more experienced subordinates believed he lacked evidence. At first, no one knew whether or not the Soviet missiles had nuclear warheads, but by September 19, evidence that they did had started accumulating. On September 27, the U.S. military began preparing contingency invasion plans for Cuba. JFK was briefed on October 16 that hard photographic evidence from a U-2 spy plane flight confirmed that Soviet medium-range nuclear ballistic missiles were being installed in Cuba. He made plans to reveal the crisis to the nation 6 days later, after having daily consultations with a full range of top military and civilian advisors. On October 22, 1962, at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, President John F. Kennedy went on national television to tell the American people the country was on the brink of nuclear war. Families across America were riveted to their television screens as Kennedy described the missiles and the blockade of Cuba he was instituting to be sure that no more offensive military equipment reached the island. Essentially, JFK drew a blockade line around Cuba, one that several Soviet ships were fast approaching. As the Cuban Missile Crisis unfolded during those tense times, it's important to remember that this is when recently returned defector Lee Oswald was allowed to take the job at the U-2 map firm in Dallas. The firm's sensitive work would be visible on television throughout the crisis, which makes it incredible that Oswald would be allowed to work there unless he had U.S. intelligence connections. William Harvey had his own idea about how to handle the crisis. Thomas Powers writes that on October 21, 1962, the day before President Kennedy announced a blockade of Cuba in a television speech, a CIA team headed by future Watergate burglar Eugenio Martinez landed two agents on the northern coast of Cuba. At least one other team made a similar landing the same night. Harvey told a subcommittee of the National Security Council that several agents had already landed and there was no way to communicate with them and thus no way to recall them. However, the New York Daily News later tracked down intelligence sources who confirmed that one of Harvey's teams was actually an execution squad sent to ambush Castro near Santiago de Cuba as he drove to a memorial service. Snipers hid among trees and bushes lining the road. Machine guns and rifles sprayed the second Jeep of a five-Jeep motorcade with bullets, killing the driver and his passenger, who turned out to be Castro's look-alike bodyguard. Robert Kennedy was furious when he found out and wanted CIA Director McCone to immediately fire Harvey, but Helms talked both men out of it. The CIA, in particular Richard Helms, would take similar unauthorized action the following year in a way that inadvertently aided the plans of Marcello, Trafficante, and Rosselli to assassinate President Kennedy. While those events were building and unfolding, Marcello and Trafficante were consumed by the Kennedys' war against them and the rest of the Mafia. Marcello faced an $850,000 tax assessment, as well as indictment for illegal reentry, new McClellan Committee hearings, an indictment for conspiracy and perjury, and now the deportation order was upheld after an unsuccessful appeal, wrote John Davis. He added, "People close to the Marcellos at this time have remarked that the family's hatred of Robert Kennedy knew no bounds." The IRS busted Santo Trafficante's Orlando gambling operations and even arrested two of his family members. According to historian Richard Mahoney, the IRS had launched an audit of Rosselli's tax records in February 1962, and an FBI detail secretly scrutinized all his banking and stock transactions. He notes that Rosselli grew openly bitter. He told one associate of Jack Ruby, "I'm being run right into the ground. It's terrible. Here I am, helping the government, helping the country, and that little son of a bitch is breaking my balls." Rosselli's boss, Chicago godfather Sam Giancana, was also facing pressure from the FBI at RFK's urging. Jimmy Hoffa, who had a number of criminal activities with Marcello and Trafficante, was under such intense pressure from the Kennedys that he decided to kill Robert Kennedy. In September 1962, Edward Parton, the Justice Department informant who had witnessed Marcello's $500,000 bribe to Hoffa for Nixon, approached officials about becoming an informant after he heard Jimmy Hoffa discuss plans to assassinate Attorney General Kennedy. Parton had passed a meticulous FBI polygraph examination and had provided to RFK's Justice Department a stream of information about Hoffa's crimes. Hoffa trusted Parton, a Louisiana Teamster official, and told him about two different plans he was considering to end RFK's war against him and the Mafia. One plan involved firebombing Hickory Hill, Robert Kennedy's Virginia estate, hoping that RFK would either be killed by the blast or would be incinerated, since the place will burn after it blows up. Jimmy Hoffa's other plan to murder Robert Kennedy was to have him shot to death from a distance away by a gunman without any traceable connection to Hoffa and the Teamsters, and using a high-powered rifle with a telescopic sight. Hoffa thought the best place to do it would be somewhere in the South while Kennedy was in a convertible. Jimmy Hoffa declared to Parton that somebody needs to bump that son of a bitch, RFK, off. Parton said that Hoffa also badly hated President Kennedy. He'd fly off when JFK's name was even mentioned. However, by the late fall of 1962, Hoffa was no longer telling Parton about his plans to assassinate RFK. Godfathers Carlos Marcello and Santo Trafficante had apparently persuaded him that the problem of Robert Kennedy required a different solution, one that didn't involve murdering the Attorney General, despite Marcello's visceral hatred of RFK and JFK. Instead, assassinating JFK was the way to end RFK's war against the mob bosses. By the fall of 1962, Carlos Marcello had been safely back at home in Louisiana for more than a year, following his humiliating ordeal in the jungles of Central America. His organization had quickly recovered from his absence and was more profitable than ever. However, John and Robert Kennedy had only increased their pressure on Marcello and his mafia allies, and were now mounting the largest assault on organized crime America had ever seen. Attorney General Robert Kennedy had finally persuaded FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to begin fighting the mob. Not content to depend on the aging and imperious Hoover, RFK had hired 10 times more Justice Department mafia prosecutors than were employed during the Eisenhower-Nixon administration. the Kennedys' pressure on Marcello and on his close partners, Santo Traficante and Jimmy Hoffa, was unrelenting. Something had to be done. In October 1962, Marcello briefly and unexpectedly explained his solution to the Kennedys' war on the Mafia. The Godfather was with two of his most trusted associates in the place he felt safest, the middle of his secluded 6,400-acre Churchill Farms property outside New Orleans. With Marcello were his trusted longtime driver, Jack Liberto, and his favorite nephew, Carlo Rapolo. Joining the three was Ed Becker, a former public relations man for two Las Vegas casinos. Marcello felt comfortable talking to Becker not only because he'd worked for mob-run casinos, but because Becker was now in business with Rapolo, who vouched for him. According to Becker, Marcello pulled out a bottle and poured a generous round of scotch. The conversation wandered until Becker made an offhand remark about Robert Kennedy and Marcello's deportation. The reference struck a nerve, and Carlos jumped to his feet, exclaiming the Sicilian oath, "Levarsi na pietra della scarpa," take the stone out of my shoe. Marcello didn't speak Sicilian, but was repeating an old saying he had heard many times from those who did. As Becker later wrote, reverting to English, Marcello shouted, "Don't worry about that Bobby son of a bitch. He's going to be taken care of." Becker told the Godfather that killing RFK would get Marcello into a hell of a lot of trouble. In answer, Marcello invoked an old Italian proverb, "If you want to kill a dog, you don't cut off the tail, you cut off the head." Becker says the implication was that Bobby was the tail, and if the president were killed, then Bobby would lose his bite. Marcello added that he had a plan to use a nut to take the fall for the murder. Then Marcello abruptly changed the subject, and the Kennedys were not mentioned again. Many people knew that Robert Kennedy and Vice President Johnson hated each other, and one of them was the politically savvy Marcello, who owned U.S. senators, members of Congress, governors, and judges. If Marcello killed President Kennedy, then RFK's status as the second most powerful man in America, with far more power than a typical attorney general, would end. And with it, so would RFK's extraordinary war on Marcello and the Mafia. According to all accounts of the incident, Becker related his encounter with Marcello to the FBI soon after the meeting and well before the Kennedy assassination, but no action was taken by the Bureau. In addition, former FBI agent Julian Blodgett, who was familiar with Becker at the time, corroborates Becker's account. The House Select Committee on Assassinations investigated Becker's story, took his sworn testimony, and found him and his account credible. In the fall of 1962, around the same time Marcello told Ed Becker about his plan to assassinate JFK, Godfather Santo Traficante made a similar comment to an associate named Jose Aleman. Traficante confirmed to congressional investigators that he knew Aleman and acknowledged having met with him on business approximately three times, although some accounts put the number much higher. Aleman's family had long-standing mafia ties. Former FBI agent William Turner notes that Jose Aleman's grandfather had been Lucky Luciano's lawyer in Havana. Aleman's family had recently helped Jimmy Hoffa gain control of a Miami bank that Hoffa could use to launder money from his criminal activities. Also, Aleman knew Rolando Cubela, the disgruntled mid-level Cuban official and CIA asset, who had his own ties to Traficante associates. According to the Washington Post, Jose Aleman had been a rich young revolutionary in Havana whose considerable wealth involved Miami real estate, including the Miami Stadium. But after losing his land holdings in Cuba to the revolution and the death of his father, Aleman was forced to sell the Miami Stadium and other Miami real estate, except for the three-story motel where Aleman would meet with Traficante in 1962. By the fall of that year, Aleman was in debt, though his contacts and reputation could still be of use to someone like Traficante, who was always looking for seemingly legitimate fronts for money laundering and other scams. The Post notes that Aleman became involved with Traficante in 1962 through his cousin, a resourceful lawyer for Traficante. Aleman testified under oath to the House Select Committee on Assassinations that in 1962, an associate of Traficante came to me and he said, "Santo wants to meet you." Aleman said he was initially reluctant since he had to testify against Santo's people in 1960 in a complex case involving Traficante associates. Aleman had been a reluctant witness, and his testimony had not been especially damaging. Aleman said that despite his initial reluctance, he did ultimately go to meetings with Traficante. Aleman said that Traficante made the threat against JFK as part of a long conversation that lasted from sometime during the day until late at night. Aleman said the conversation with Traficante came about because his cousin had helped get someone out of a Cuban jail, and Traficante wanted to help Aleman get out of his financial difficulties in return. To the congressional investigators, Aleman attempted to explain why Traficante would have contact with him, much less offer him assistance, in view of the fact that Aleman had testified for the state. Aleman said he explicitly told Traficante about his testimony, but Traficante laughed out loud and said not to worry about it, that it didn't matter at all. According to the Washington Post, Aleman had been subpoenaed by the FBI to testify, and Aleman tried to avoid testifying, but the FBI reminded him that if he did not cooperate, he might be subject to prosecution for illegal gun running. The Post said that Traficante had offered to arrange a $1 million loan for Aleman from the Teamsters Union, which had already been cleared by Jimmy Hoffa himself. It was natural that the conversation turned to Hoffa when Traficante met Aleman at the Cott Bryant Hotel in Miami in September 1962. Aleman told congressional investigators that Traficante complained about JFK. "Have you seen how his brother is hitting Hoffa? Mark my word, this man Kennedy is in trouble and he will get what is coming to him." When Aleman disagreed with Traficante and said he thought Kennedy would be reelected, Traficante said, "You don't understand me. Kennedy's not going to make it to the election. He's going to be hit." Aleman told the government investigators that Traficante made it clear he was not guessing about the killing. Rather, he was giving the impression that he knew Kennedy was going to be killed. According to historian Richard Mahoney, Aleman later maintained that he reported this comment to two Miami FBI agents. Another historian confirmed, "Disturbed by what had transpired at that meeting, Aleman immediately began informing on Traficante to two FBI agents at the FBI's Miami field office, but Traficante's hints were apparently judged mere gangland braggadocio." The historian goes on to write that 30 years later, Aleman's accusations would resist positive confirmation, with bureau records of his debriefings remaining classified. One of the Miami FBI agents, when advised of Aleman's allegations, would affirm, "He's a reliable individual." The Washington Post notes that after Aleman testified for the state, Aleman's relationship with the Bureau grew very close. The FBI men came to rely on him. Declassified files I found bear that out and show that Aleman continued to provide information about Traficante to the FBI through 1964. The House Select Committee on Assassinations found Aleman and his story of Traficante's threats credible. The committee found that Santo Traficante's stature in the national syndicate of organized crime, notably the violent narcotics trade, and his role as the mob's chief liaison to criminal figures within the Cuban exile community, provided him with the capability of formulating an assassination conspiracy against President Kennedy. In addition, the House Select Committee found that examination of the FBI's electronic surveillance program of the early 1960s disclosed that Santo Traficante was the subject of minimal, in fact almost non-existent, surveillance coverage. During one conversation in 1963, overheard in a Miami restaurant, Traficante had bitterly attacked the Kennedy administration's efforts against organized crime, making obscene comments about Kennedy's right-hand man, who had recently coordinated various raids on Traficante gambling establishments. In the conversation, Traficante stated that he was under immense pressure from federal investigators, commenting, "I know when I'm beat, you understand?" Like his partner, Carlos Marcello, Santo Traficante felt like he had been backed into a corner by the Kennedys and had nothing to lose by trying to assassinate JFK. Soon, Johnny Roselli joined them in their plotting, and new developments in the secret war between the United States and Cuba gave the three mob bosses a way to kill JFK while forcing high U.S. officials to withhold crucial evidence from the press, the public, and each other. Even as Marcello and Traficante plotted their murder of President Kennedy, John and Robert Kennedy were working frantically behind the scenes to defuse the tense standoff of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nuclear-armed Soviet missiles in Cuba were aimed at the United States, just 90 miles away, and at the height of the Cold War, any miscalculation could spell disaster. President Kennedy reached an agreement with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. The United States secretly agreed to remove U.S. Jupiter missiles in Turkey targeted at Russia, while Khrushchev would remove the Soviet missiles from Cuba. However, a myth has persisted ever since that Kennedy struck a deal with Khrushchev binding the U.S. to a commitment not to invade Cuba, even though historians from the nonprofit National Security Archive at George Washington University first documented 20 years ago that that was not the case. Files declassified 30 years after the missile crisis revealed that no such deal was ever made. They explained that President Kennedy's pledge not to invade Cuba was conditioned on the implementation of adequate inspection and verification procedures. As JFK wrote to Khrushchev, only upon the establishment of adequate arrangements through the United Nations to ensure that all missiles had been removed would the United States give assurances against an invasion of Cuba. But as the National Security Archive historians documented, Cuba did not allow on-site inspection by the United Nations to verify the removal of the Russian missiles, so the pledge never took effect. JFK's Secretary of State at the time, Dean Rusk, confirmed that to me in a 1990 interview, explaining that Fidel Castro had been angry that he wasn't consulted before Khrushchev made the deal with JFK and therefore refused to allow UN weapons inspectors into Cuba. In JFK's November 20, 1962 primetime press conference, he reaffirmed the need for UN inspections before putting a no-invasion pledge into effect. In response to the question, if we wanted to invade Cuba, could we do so without the approval of the United Nations? JFK gave a carefully worded reply, saying that the United States reserved the right to act against Cuba on our own if that situation was necessary to protect our survival or integrity or other vital interests. Just over a year later, the specter of the Cuban Missile Crisis and a secret Cuba plan begun by JFK 6 months after the crisis apparently ended would loom large over the secrecy surrounding his own assassination. Central to understanding all that secrecy was a man who grew close to Robert Kennedy in the days after the crisis appeared to have passed, Cuban exile Enrique Harry Ruiz Williams. Harry Williams, as he liked to be called, was a wounded survivor of the Bay of Pigs. He was one of 60 injured men Castro had released 7 months earlier to spur U.S. efforts to ransom the remaining prisoners, an effort that had been constantly thwarted by Richard Nixon and other conservatives. Before Williams and the others were released, Cuban authorities told the men they had to return to prison in Cuba by the end of 1962 if the United States did not ransom the remaining prisoners. Worse, they were told that one Bay of Pigs prisoner would be shot for each released prisoner who didn't return. At 40, Williams was older than most of the other exile fighters. He had been a mining engineer, raising a family in Cuba before the revolution. After his release in 1962, Williams took a leading role in trying to win the release of his comrades, who remained in prison. The Kennedys were sympathetic, and Harry developed a working relationship with Robert Kennedy, while trying to find some way to free the prisoners. Both JFK and RFK admired Williams because of his courage, which he had demonstrated on two notable occasions during and immediately after the Bay of Pigs disaster. Once ashore in Cuba, Williams fought bravely and was blown into the air by an enemy shell and hit by more than 70 pieces of shrapnel. Both of his feet were smashed, and he had a hole near his heart and a large one in his neck, according to one Cuban exile historian. Williams was near death when Castro's army brought him to a makeshift field hospital. What happened next became the stuff of legend among Cuban exiles. As Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Haynes Johnson wrote, Williams and the other wounded men in a makeshift field hospital were suddenly confronted by the person of Fidel Castro. The badly wounded Williams recognized him at once. He groped under his thin mattress and tried to reach a .45 pistol he had concealed there earlier in the afternoon. As Williams told me, and as other exiles confirmed to Haynes, Williams gathered enough strength to point the weapon at Castro and at almost point-blank range to pull the trigger. But the weapon only clicked. It was empty. Earlier, Williams' compatriots had worried that he might be in such pain from his wounds and so depressed over the failure of the invasion and their capture that he might use the gun on himself, so they removed the bullets while Williams was unconscious. Castro's men quickly set upon Williams, but Fidel ordered them not to harm the gravely injured man, and instead ordered that Williams and the other wounded men be taken to a hospital in a nearby city. There, an old friend, Cuban Army Commander Juan Almeida, visited Williams. Almeida was no doubt frustrated that the United States had never acted on his clear signals of dissatisfaction with Castro. Commander Almeida told Williams that the time for action against Fidel was not right, that he was too powerful in the wake of his victory at the Bay of Pigs. Almeida could not have known it then, but that situation would finally change 6 months after the Cuban Missile Crisis. The missile crisis put on hold Williams' efforts to persuade John and Robert Kennedy to ransom the remaining Bay of Pigs prisoners. Robert Kennedy was impressed when Williams volunteered to guide U.S. troops on a mission to rescue the remaining prisoners if the United States had to attack Cuba during the crisis to take out the Soviet missiles. After the missile crisis, as Castro's end-of-the-year deadline approached, Robert Kennedy was shocked when Williams began making preparations to return to Cuba. Castro had given Williams and the others only until the end of the year to ransom the remaining prisoners. If the ransom was not paid, they had to return, and one prisoner would be shot for each man who did not. So Williams felt he had no choice but to go back to Cuba. John and Robert Kennedy felt great sympathy for the prisoners' plight, but freeing them now became a personal matter for RFK. As documented by Haynes Johnson, Robert Kennedy moved heaven and earth in December 1962 to try to win the prisoners' release, searching for a ransom acceptable to both Fidel Castro and JFK's Republican opponents. JFK, RFK, their aides, and Williams were successful, and $53 million in food and medicine was transferred to Cuba. On Christmas Eve, the 1,113 prisoners returned to Miami. The Orange Bowl hosted a lavish ceremony for all the freed prisoners and their families, during which JFK made an impromptu pledge, promising to return the brigade's flag to them in a free Havana. For President Kennedy, those weren't just words. Operation Mongoose was officially over, but 6 months later, JFK, RFK, and Williams would have a new plan to topple Fidel, one that would trigger much of the secrecy that still surrounds JFK's assassination. Chapter 8. Marcello meets with Ruby and Oswald. By early 1963, Carlos Marcello appears to have been working with well-connected New Orleans private detective Guy Bannister and pilot David Ferry to set up Lee Oswald in relation to JFK's assassination. U.S. covert operations against Cuba would give Bannister and Ferry a way to accomplish that task. Though Operation Mongoose had ended, small-scale U.S. covert actions against Cuba continued, and JM Wave, the huge Miami CIA station, remained active. The United States also continued to distribute hundreds of thousands of dollars a month to a variety of Cuban exile organizations and leaders, including Tony Varona. According to the CIA's deputy chief in New Orleans, Hunter A. Leak, both Bannister and Ferry continued to work for the CIA, and Cuba seems to have been their main focus. According to historian Michael Kurtz, Leak had admitted to him that Bannister served as a key CIA liaison with many anti-Castro Cuban refugees in southern Louisiana. Bannister often handled details of the training and supplying of various anti-Castro organizations. Typically, Hunter Leak or another CIA agent from the New Orleans office would meet Bannister in Mancuso's restaurant, located in the infamous 544 Camp Street building. The reasons for that building's infamy were noted in Chapter 2 and are explained later. Kurtz wrote that the CIA's leak provided Bannister with substantial sums of cash, and Bannister would use the money to purchase needed supplies and to pay the salaries of the men working in certain anti-Castro operations. As for Ferry, Leak told Kurtz that the pilot performed a series of tasks for the CIA, which included conducting propaganda sessions among refugee units, thus reinforcing their hatred of the Castro regime, and serving as an intermediary between the CIA and organized crime. The latter would have been easy for Ferry in 1963, since he, like Bannister, was working for Carlos Marcello. Even though the official record shows that Oswald moved to New Orleans in April 24, 1963, he had made at least one trip to the city well before that date, according to congressional testimony cited in Chapter 2. The testimony was first obtained in 1975, meaning that critical information was not available to the Warren Commission. Oswald's visit had occurred in March, February, or perhaps as early as January. His trip there involved some sort of Cuba-related activity, resulting in his being jailed in New Orleans and claiming to the INS to be a Cuban exile, even though he couldn't speak Spanish. Within a few months, numerous witnesses would place Oswald as working with Guy Bannister and David Ferry. However, Oswald's unusual visit to New Orleans in early 1963, missing from Warren Commission records, suggests that he'd had contact with them well before that, which might even explain his later move to New Orleans. In early 1963, Oswald engaged in several unusual activities that provoked controversy for decades. However, when viewed through the lens of the intelligence connections of Bannister and Ferry, and their work for Carlos Marcello, Oswald's actions make perfect sense. Oswald's suspicious activities in the space of less than 2 months included apparently using an alias to order a pistol and a rifle through the mail, photographing himself holding both weapons and two communist newspapers of opposing views, being linked to a shooting at the home of far-right racist retired General Edwin Walker, and writing letters to the head of the pro-Castro Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Some of those activities are consistent with simply maintaining and building his cover as a communist Marxist while continuing to avoid meeting or talking to any real American communists or socialists. Other actions appear to have been undertaken in cooperation with or on the orders of someone else. First, it seems odd that Oswald would order guns through the mail when cheaper and more reliable weapons were easily available in Dallas. Likewise, it seems strange for Oswald to suddenly develop a great interest in Cuba and to begin a phony one-man chapter of a small organization called the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, when both Dallas and New Orleans had legitimate far-left and socialist organizations that he could have joined. In early 1963, as Marcello and Traficante were making plans to assassinate JFK, two related congressional committees were looking into the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and into mail-order gun sales by the very firms from which Oswald ordered. Not only were both hearings in the newspapers of the time, making it easy to see where Bannister or his associates got the idea to take advantage of them, but members of both congressional committees had ties to Traficante operatives Frank Fiorini and John Martino. Martino, who had finally been released from his Cuban prison the previous fall, was very bitter over his experience, blaming the Kennedy administration for not securing his release sooner. In addition to his work for Traficante, in 1963 Martino also became close to Johnny Rosselli, and the CIA admits that Martino, like Rosselli, became a CIA asset. Also like Rosselli and Marcello and Traficante, late in life Martino admitted his involvement in the JFK assassination plot. As explained in Chapter 2, it's also important to keep in mind that Oswald was still under tight surveillance by naval intelligence, with the assistance of the CIA. Both during Oswald's early 1963 trip to New Orleans and after he moved there in late April, Bannister and Ferry were well positioned to assist the CIA and naval intelligence with that surveillance. Oswald was probably encouraged first to write and then to join the Fair Play for Cuba Committee to further legitimize U.S. intelligence objectives for the CIA and naval intelligence. These include making him more attractive for KGB recruitment, laying the groundwork for involving Oswald in anti-Castro operations, and making him part of CIA officer David Atlee Phillips' efforts to penetrate and compromise the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Oswald probably ordered the weapons at the behest of someone working for the mafia, such as Bannister or Ferry. Given their work for Marcello at the time, it was all too easy for them to manipulate Oswald under the guise of furthering some U.S. intelligence activity. As for the shooting at General Walker's home, Bannister belonged to the same white supremacist circles as General Walker, and associates of the two had been at a white supremacist conference in New Orleans just 4 days before someone shot into Walker's home. Any role Oswald had in that incident was probably at Bannister's behest, an effort to plant evidence that would make Oswald look murderously violent after he was arrested for JFK's assassination. A closer look at the timing of all these events shows just how intertwined they were, and reveals other links to the mafia's role in JFK's assassination. First, here's a brief summary. Someone using the alias Alec Hedel and Oswald's post office box in Dallas ordered a .38 caliber pistol on January 28 from a Los Angeles company and ordered a Mannlicher Carcano rifle from a Chicago firm on March 12, 1963. Both weapons were shipped the same day, March 20. On March 31, Oswald's wife, Marina, photographed him in his backyard holding both weapons and the two communists' newspapers. In the first week of April, Oswald was fired from his job at the U2 map firm in Dallas, and he wrote his first letter to the head of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. On April 10, a bullet was fired into the Dallas home of General Walker. On April 24, Oswald moved to New Orleans, where he initially lived with his uncle, a bookie for Carlos Marcello. As for the guns, journalist Henry Hurt wrote that the theory that Oswald chose to acquire his guns by mail has never made much sense. Its only value is to the official version of events by creating a chain of documentary evidence to link Oswald to the weapons supposedly responsible for the murders of President Kennedy and Officer Tippit, even though the same make of rifle and revolver could have been purchased by Oswald at stores only a few blocks from where he worked in Dallas. Hurt points out that under the laws at the time, there would have been no record of his purchase and ownership had he bought the guns at a store, as there would be for mail-order guns. By using the mails, Oswald appears to have deliberately left much more of a trail than if he had made the same purchase by spending a few minutes at a busy gun shop's counter. The mail-order guns also tied Oswald's actions to a Senate committee investigating mail-order weapons. Some of the committee's members were at the same time investigating the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Guy Bannister had worked for racist Mississippi Senator James O. Eastland, chairman of the Senate committee investigating Fair Play for Cuba. Eastland would soon be working on a covert CIA operation involving John Martino, Johnny Rosselli, and Santo Trafficante. Trafficante operative Frank Fiorini later admitted to having intelligence connections to Eastland's Senate committee. Those connections, and the newspaper headlines the hearings generated, would have made it possible for Guy Bannister to manipulate Oswald into thinking he was assisting those committees by ordering the guns and writing to the Fair Play for Cuba committee. Historian George Michael Ivica notes that between Oswald's conveniently timed mail-order gun purchases and his contact with the Fair Play for Cuba committee, Oswald could not have set up a more consistent pattern had he been working, whether directly or indirectly, for the Senate committees. That may be exactly what Oswald thought he was doing. Oswald may well have thought that if he followed the orders of Bannister and Ferry, he might someday be testifying before Congress like his boyhood hero from I Led Three Lives. Under that scenario, Oswald would think he was assisting the committees by showing that a former Russian defector and a Fair Play for Cuba committee member could easily order a rifle and pistol through the mail, when, in actuality, he was being set up. In addition, John Newman, historian and retired Army intelligence major, discovered that the Chicago FBI office launched a major investigation of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee on March 8, 1963, 4 days before Oswald seems to have ordered the rifle from Chicago. Recall that Bannister was a former FBI chief in Chicago. Newman also notes that word of the FBI investigation of the FPCC was transmitted to the CIA for some reason, something that was not always the case. There were more Fair Play for Cuba committee hearings on March 13, 1963, the same day Oswald appears to have ordered his rifle. On March 31, Lee Oswald wrote his first letter to the head of the Fair Play for Cuba committee. That was also the day Oswald had his wife, Marina, take the famous photos of him holding his recently arrived mail-order rifle. More Senate Fair Play for Cuba committee hearings were held on April 3, 1963, and just over 2 weeks later, Oswald wrote another letter to the head of that organization. In the meantime, someone had fired a shot into General Walker's home on April 10. Oswald moved to New Orleans on April 24, 1963, after surreptitiously visiting the city earlier that year. The shooting at General Walker's was termed an assassination attempt by Walker and the Warren Commission, and when word of it emerged soon after JFK's assassination, it seemed to some to clinch the case against the deceased Oswald. However, Walker's background, the evidence, and the actions of Marcello associates such as Oswald and Ruby suggest a different interpretation of the shooting. General Walker became controversial in 1961 when JFK removed him from command of the 24th Infantry Division in Germany for indoctrinating his soldiers with inflammatory material from the John Birch Society. That material made ridiculous claims, such as saying that former President Dwight Eisenhower was consciously serving the communist conspiracy for all his adult life. General Walker resigned, and in September 1962, when James Meredith tried to become the first black student to enroll at the University of Mississippi, Walker went to the campus and delivered incendiary racist remarks full of blatant lies and distortions. Walker's opposition march erupted into a riot that left 2 dead and 70 injured. The Kennedys had Walker arrested and placed under psychological observation, but after his release, he returned to his home in Dallas and ran for governor of Texas. Following his defeat, Walker continued making outrageous claims and speeches as he railed against the Kennedys, civil rights, and Castro. Walker flew the Confederate flag in front of his home, and later made a well-publicized visit of support to Byron Della Beckwith, Medgar Evers' assassin. Walker moved in the same far-right, racist circles as Guy Bannister, whose close friend wrote a book praising Walker. Walker also apparently knew another Marcello subordinate, Jack Ruby. According to an FBI memo, Walker's handyman said he saw Jack Ruby visiting General Walker on several occasions. Ruby called at the Walker residence on a monthly basis from December 1962 through March 1963. Ruby stayed approximately 1 hour at Walker's home and talked with Walker behind closed doors. The Walker shooting occurred soon after Ruby's last visit to Walker's house. For the April 10 shooting at Walker's, we have only the word of Walker that he was even in the room where the shot was fired. Otherwise, a shot fired into an empty room would be little more than a case of serious vandalism. Walker's long-standing pattern of public lies and exaggerations in regard to civil rights and minorities calls into question his overly dramatic story of lowering his head just as the bullet was fired into the room. The Warren Commission and others have tried to pin the Walker shooting exclusively on Oswald to show a propensity for murderous violence that is otherwise missing in Oswald's background. But numerous journalists and authors have pointed out serious problems with that theory. Witnesses saw at least two people at the shooting, and at least two cars were involved in suspicious activity around Walker's house. None of the witnesses said any of the men looked like Oswald, and Walker's night watchman said the driver of a suspicious 1957 Chevrolet he spotted casing the house a few days earlier looked Cuban. In addition, Oswald couldn't drive and didn't own a car, raising the ludicrous spectacle of Oswald walking along the sidewalk or suspiciously skulking through suburban alleys with his rifle, or else taking his rifle on the bus to Walker's home. Even disassembled, the rifle would have been so long as to provoke the suspicions of those he encountered, at least the following day when they learned about the shooting and recalled seeing a young man in the area with an unusually long package. While others were involved in the incident, Lee Oswald's statements to Marina and to his CIA monitor George de Morenschild make it clear that Oswald was as well. Since others were involved in the Walker incident with Oswald, meaning it was a conspiracy, there's a strong indication that others were involved in what happened to JFK. In addition, research by Dick Russell and Anthony Summers strongly indicates that the Walker shooting was not an assassination attempt at all. Instead, it was a stunt to publicize General Walker, who faced a fading career as a reactionary extremist. Walker's breathless story to reporters that he was almost killed and would have been shot in the head if he hadn't bent down at just the right moment generated tremendous regional and national publicity. Guy Bannister got what he wanted, publicity for a white supremacist ally, a test of whether he could manipulate Oswald into dealing with firearms, and several actions on Oswald's part that would incriminate him after JFK's death. Since Oswald had begun the Cuban phase of his covert activity just 10 days before the Walker incident, with a letter to the national chairman of the small Fair Play for Cuba committee, his actions in relation to Walker were probably designed to test his abilities for his new assignment. Unlike Oswald's previous defect and return Russian assignment, anti-Castro operations demanded a new set of skills, from surreptitiously arranging and attending meetings and keeping them secret from his wife, to dealing with firearms in a covert way. The Walker incident was a chance to see if Oswald, who had never served in combat, could handle that type of assignment. Given Oswald's dramatic increase in Cuban activity in the months after the Walker incident, he obviously passed the test, whether he fired the shot or was involved in some other capacity. By late April 1963, Oswald was living with his uncle, Dutz Murat, a bookie for Carlos Marcello, and he would do so for 2 weeks, until Marina Oswald joined him in New Orleans and they got their own apartment. When Oswald moved in with Carlos Marcello's bookie, the Godfather himself was waiting on word about his appeal to the Supreme Court regarding a new deportation order, which had been spearheaded by Attorney General Robert Kennedy. Soon after, John Davis said that Marcello received word that the Supreme Court declined to review the Marcello deportation action. The decision was prominently reported in the New Orleans papers and meant that all Carlos's appeals were exhausted. With that defeat, the pressure increased many times over on Marcello to take action against the Kennedys in order to preserve his freedom and his empire. As 1963 wore on, Marcello's allies in the plot to murder JFK faced similar pressure from the Kennedys. Santo Traficante came under ever-increasing scrutiny from the Kennedys, who busted his operations and made increasing use of IRS tax liens against him. RFK also made the very private and reclusive Traficante the focus of major congressional hearings. Finally, by subpoenaing Traficante's wife, the Kennedys had broken what Traficante considered an unwritten law. Traficante did plenty of philandering, as did Marcello, but the Godfathers liked to maintain the image of being traditional family men, and their wives had been considered off-limits during the previous decade. The FBI also still dogged Johnny Rosselli, except when he was working on the CIA mafia plots to kill Castro. His boss, Sam Giancana, was put under lockstep surveillance by the FBI at the urging of Robert Kennedy, crippling Giancana's ability to function and preventing him from having an active role in JFK's assassination. Rosselli's power in Las Vegas and Hollywood flowed from Sam Giancana's high position with the Chicago mob. So unless Roselli could eliminate RFK's pressure on Giancana, Roselli's own future looked dim. Remarkably, even as the Kennedy brothers increased their attacks on the mob bosses, the crime families still conducted their deadly business as usual, even assassinating a government official in the United States. A Chicago mobster who was a close friend of Ruby was credited by law enforcement officials with the murder of Chicago Alderman Benjamin F. Lewis, as documented by investigative journalist Dan Maldea. The Chicago official was found dead on February 28, 1963, face down in a 4-foot-wide pool of blood, after the back of his head had been shot off by 3 bullets. His assassination was the 977th unsolved underworld hit in Chicago since the early 1900s. While law enforcement officials knew who did the killing, no one was ever tried and convicted for the crime. Such killings showed why Roselli, Marcello, and Trafficante viewed a much more carefully planned hit on a much higher official as a viable solution to their mutual problems with the Kennedys. In the spring of 1963, Carlos Marcello made more documented remarks about assassinating President Kennedy, only this time his comments were not to Ed Becker. They were made to a much closer associate and were not disclosed until the publication of John Davis's biography of Marcello in 1989. At that time, Marcello had been carefully planning JFK's murder with his allies for about 6 months. Davis wrote that one spring weekend in 1963, Marcello was at his fishing lodge at Grand Isle, Louisiana, with close friends from the old Sicilian families of New Orleans. While having a scotch with one of them in the kitchen, a friend of Marcello's friend made a casual reference to an article he had read about the Supreme Court upholding Marcello's deportation order. At the mention of Robert Kennedy's name, Carlos suddenly seemed to choke, spitting out his scotch on the floor. Recovering quickly, he formed the Southern Italian symbol of the horn with this left hand. Holding the ancient symbol of hatred and revenge above his head, he shouted, "Don't worry, man, about that Bobby. We going to take care of that son of a bitch." The friend asked if Marcello was going to give it to Bobby, but Marcello replied, "What could that do? You hit that man and his brother calls out the National Guard." "No, you gotta hit the top man. And what happened with the next top man? He don't like the brother." Marcello declared to his friend, "Sure as I stand here, something awful is gonna happen to that man." Marcello knew that if he killed the Attorney General, JFK would simply order the National Guard or the Army into Marcello's strongholds, much as had happened in 1954 in Phoenix City, Alabama, after Trafficante's associates killed the Alabama Attorney General-elect. That would render powerless the political figures in Louisiana and elsewhere that Marcello had corrupted and relied on for protection. For Marcello and his associates, that meant the answer was to kill JFK, not RFK. The animosity between RFK and Vice President Lyndon Johnson, who would be the new president, was well known, and Johnson had never made prosecuting the mafia any sort of priority. History would prove Marcello's reasoning to be largely correct. Confirmation of Marcello's spring 1963 remarks about assassinating JFK comes from Atlanta businessman John Knight Sr., who grew up in Louisiana. Knight's father, a merchant in Lafayette, owned 1/3 interest in a 45-foot boat docked at Grand Isle, a popular fishing area on the Gulf of Mexico, 100 miles southwest of New Orleans. After one of the boat's other owners sold his fishing camp at Grand Isle to Carlos Marcello, the teenaged Knight was introduced to Marcello by Felix Kiger, 43 years old, who cooked and looked after the camp. Later that spring, Knight's father was angry when he heard that Marcello was going to be using his boat. Knight and his father raced to the dock, but the vessel was already pulling away. They were told that a Los Angeles mobster was also on the boat with Marcello and Kiger. Many days later, Knight was talking to Kiger, and after a couple glasses of wine, Kiger became emotional when speaking about Marcello. Kiger said, "Something bad is going to happen to our president." The distraught cook said that he had been cooking while Marcello and the Los Angeles mobster were talking. They don't think Kiger hears him, but the man gleaned from their conversation that JFK was going to be the target of an attack planned by Marcello. Knight asked Kiger why Marcello would want to do such a thing to President Kennedy. Kiger replied that it was because of Robert Kennedy's sudden deportation of Marcello and the harrowing ordeal Marcello had to endure. Not long after Marcello managed to sneak back into the United States, Kiger saw the Godfather and said his hands and knees were still raw from injuries he had suffered in Central America. Marcello wasn't linked to JFK's assassination in the press until the late 1970s, so Knight didn't fully appreciate the ramifications of what Kiger had told him for years. Knight's account appears credible and is full of additional specific names and details. Jack Ruby's good friend Joe Campisi, a Marcello underboss, later testified to congressional investigators that Marcello goes to Grand Isle every year since he has a camp there. Campisi admitted meeting with Marcello at the camp, showing that the Godfather felt secure conducting mob business there. In 1963, Carlos Marcello actually had at least one face-to-face meeting with Lee Oswald. Marcello's meeting with the nephew of his longtime bookie, Dutz Murat, was revealed by the Godfather to Jack Van Lanningen 22 years later during the Camtex undercover FBI operation. Van Lanningen later explained to me how Marcello's admission came about, but he prepared a written account 3 years after Marcello's remarks that can be found in the FBI's declassified Camtex file. In addition, a remarkable amount of independent evidence supports Marcello's Oswald admission. Jack Van Lanningen explained that there was only one other inmate at the federal prison that Marcello felt comfortable talking to about his New Orleans activities. Van Lanningen said, "I had another friend at Texarkana that had worked for Marcello's brother as a bartender. The little man would let him come to our room, and they would talk about New Orleans for hours. One night, Marcello was talking about the Kennedys. He told me and my friend about a meeting with Oswald. He had been introduced to Oswald by a man named Ferry, who was Marcello's pilot. He said that the meeting had taken place in his brother's restaurant. He said that he thought that Oswald was crazy. They had several meetings with Oswald before he left town." Additional confirmation of an Oswald-Marcello connection comes from another FBI informant. When the Camtex operation began targeting Marcello in 1985, he was in federal prison after being convicted of charges arising from a 1970s FBI undercover operation codenamed Brilab for bribery and labor. Brilab had grown out of the FBI investigation of a Teamster insurance scam involving Santo Traficante. As a result of that investigation, a businessman named Joe Hauser agreed to become an informant for the FBI against Carlos Marcello. He wore a wire into Marcello's office in the late 1970s, yielding the undercover Brilab tapes that eventually sent Marcello to prison in the 1980s. According to FBI informant Hauser, Marcello told him that he and some of his men did indeed know Oswald. "I used to know his fucking family. His uncle, he worked for me. That kid worked for me, too." Marcello indicated that Oswald had worked for a time as a runner for his gambling network, the same one that involved Oswald's uncle. There are only two time periods when Oswald could have worked for Marcello as a runner, one in late April and early May 1963, while he was living with Dutz Murat, and the other in late July, August, and early to mid-September 1963, when Oswald was not officially employed, but when several witnesses saw him working with Guy Bannister and David Ferry. However, starting in early August, Oswald gained a high profile in the New Orleans media for his unusually well-publicized pro-Castro activities, making it unlikely Oswald would have been used as a runner in politically conservative New Orleans at that time. As for the meeting with Oswald that Marcello described to Van Lanningen, the Godfather may have ostensibly been talking to Oswald about gambling business while checking out for himself the person who would later take the blame for JFK's murder. It's clear from other accounts that mobsters sometimes conducted mafia business at restaurants in both New Orleans and Dallas. Since the meeting place was his brother's restaurant, Carlos Marcello would have felt secure there, especially since he could have had a private dining room and private entrance to avoid being seen with Oswald. Besides, meeting with an associate's nephew and giving him a temporary job would appear, even to the restaurant's trusted staff, to simply be routine business. Marcello almost certainly did not discuss the assassination of